This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire, and that's the sound of Joseph Parker at work. He sharpens knives for a living. That saved him from fighting in Liberia's brutal civil war, and it taught him a thing or two about business.
Oh, yeah. I have a good relationship with Daniel Demasel.
I have a good rapport with my customers. We talk and have fun together, you know? As a businessman, I'm not supposed to be angry all the time. You should be very comfortable and embrace the customers. Then they'll feel free to come around you.
Then we go to the wedding of two young refugees from Pakistan's Swat Valley. And in Syria, two clerics, one Muslim, one Christian, come together to fight HIV/AIDS.
When it comes to faith, we don't have much to talk about. But when it comes to AIDS and matters of humanity, we are brothers.
That and more after this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The Middle East has the lowest incidence of HIV/AIDS in the world, but it's growing at a rate of 300% per year. One reason for the growth is denial. AIDS is seen as a Western phenomenon. But in Syria, two clerics are working to change attitudes about the disease. One is Muslim, one Christian. Will Everett reports from Damascus.
It's late Thursday night, and in the basement of Our Lady of Damascus Church, a party is in full swing. Teens in flashy clothes dance to the latest Arab pop, while chaperones watch from the sidelines to make sure they don't dance too close. Upstairs, clergymen in business suits approach the altar and lower their heads in prayer. What makes this scene extraordinary is that these are Muslim clerics. Only a few weeks ago, Christian clerics gathered at a nearby mosque for the same purpose, to show religious solidarity, as well as solidarity in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
The disease don't know the religion, the race, the color, everything. We don't know. But the diseases come from many things, many things.
That's the priest of Our Lady of Damascus, Father Taher Yosef. 4 years ago, the Greek Catholic cleric approached a group of Muslim sheikhs, or religious scholars, to discuss how to combat HIV ignorance in their congregations. Father Yusuf cites a survey that found only 2% of Syrian men and women knew that a condom can prevent the spread of HIV.
Most people here don't know anything about AIDS, but when they have questions, they're often willing to discuss it confidentially with their mullah or priest. Clerics are the only people they trust, their spiritual fathers. We have to make them feel more comfortable coming to us.
Dr. Alauddin Al-Hamawi was one of the first to bring the message to a Muslim congregation.
There aren't that many AIDS victims in Syria, so when we talk about the disease, we're usually thinking about other people, like in America. But the truth is that we have AIDS right here.
In 2005, Dr. Al-Hamawi and Father Yusuf participated in a United Nations initiative called HARPAS, the HIV regional program in the Arab states. The goal of the project is to create HIV/AIDS awareness among clerics, who then take the information to their congregations. HIV/AIDS is a taboo subject here, where sexuality isn't openly talked about. He says it's hard to know exactly how many Syrians die of AIDS each year, but the number is rising. Several years ago, one of his own flock died of AIDS. The family pretended it was cancer to avoid the public shame.
We shouldn't punish these people. We can live side by side with them. They are just like us, except that they have an illness.
And so the two clerics started distributing pamphlets on the subject and working HIV/AIDS into their sermons. Father Yusuf says that once people got over the initial surprise, they were eager for more information on the subject.
They weren't expecting it. It was like we were speaking a new language. Talking about AIDS like this is the first step in getting people to open up and tell their stories. It's giving people hope.
Christians make up only about 8% of the population here. But even with their small numbers, they're often the targets of hate crimes. Father Yusuf says that while he himself has never encountered outright hostility in Damascus, the underlying religious tension between Christians and Muslims is growing. In time, his conversations with Dr. Al-Hamawi have turned into an ongoing dialogue about peace and religious reconciliation. He says they've become best friends, though they try to shy away from talking about religion.
If we talk about religion, eventually we reach a dead end. We have different ideas. But when we talk about humanity, we can talk endlessly. We have the same goals, to bring happiness and relieve suffering.
Dr. Al-Hamawi agrees. He says that when he and Father Yusuf meet for lunch or take a long walk in the park, he can open up to Yusuf about things he'd find difficult to share with other sheikhs. Since bringing the subject of HIV/AIDS into the open, many from his mosque come to him for advice about condoms and safe sexual practice. If he doesn't have an answer, he sometimes goes to Father Yusuf.
We didn't know each other before this. When it comes to faith, we don't have much to talk about. But when it comes to AIDS and matters of humanity, we are brothers.
On a Saturday afternoon, the two clerics visit Al-Hamawi's mosque to pray. They stand in the middle of the domed chamber, surrounded by an oblong square of bright colored light shining through a stained glass window. Father Yusuf points this out to Dr. Al-Hamawi, shyly avoiding the obvious, that they're bringing light into the darkness. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett in Damascus, Syria.
Talking about AIDS is taboo in many countries. China is one of them. For years, the Chinese government has been reluctant to release any information about the disease. But recently, it announced that HIV/AIDS was the leading cause of death in China last year. Some are hoping this is a sign the government is now treating HIV as a threat to public health. The consequence of not doing that has been very clear in the past. Journalist Paul Mooney was covering a hidden AIDS epidemic in rural Henan province when he found that blood banks were a big part of the problem. Paul Mooney joins us from Beijing.
Farmers were donating blood repeatedly, and then needles were being reused. And so anyone who had AIDS or hepatitis, they were all getting infected. So it just spread quite quickly.
Why was there such a demand for blood? I mean, why were so many farmers coming in and giving blood?
The farmers needed money. They wanted to rebuild their houses, repair them. The blood collection center saw it as a moneymaker. They would sell it to hospitals at a high markup. There were shortages of blood at the time. But then the hospitals started giving people transfusions for just about any illness. Everyone thought that they could make money by doing this, and it got out of hand.
At what point were the hospitals alerted, or did the community realize there was this problem with AIDS in blood transfusions?
These blood collection centers were shut down around 1996 or 1997. At that point, they were aware. Also, farmers, I guess the government was aware that people were getting sick, and then farmers realized that they were getting sick. There were whole villages where people had gotten, AIDS from donating the blood. So it became clear by 1996 or 97 that there was a problem here.
And did they fix it? I mean, did they go out and try to help people and provide HIV/AIDS antiretroviral drugs, or did they reach out to these farming communities once they knew they were infected?
Yes and no. If someone was infected, they could get government help. But in a lot of cases, the government tried to cover it up. Basically, Henan province, and this would happen in several provinces, they were worried that if people associated, were aware that there was an AIDS problem in the province, that it would affect investment in the province. Other provinces didn't want to buy vegetables from Henan anymore. So there were patients. In the one case with this young girl, Ling Ling, she was infected at the age of 18 months. Now, the hospital didn't know it at the time, but by the time she turned 5 or 6, she was starting to get sick. This was around 2001, 2002. In 2002, the hospital had already been sued by some other patients, but for the next 4 or 5 years, the mother brought her back to the hospital repeatedly, and the hospital never told her that she was infected or suggested that any of these people be called in for examinations. And to this date, they haven't done that. So there are still people out there who don't know that they're infected.
I'd like to know a little bit more about the story of little Ling Ling. In fact, you did quite a long story about her in your own reporting. You said she was 18 months old when she was infected, but her mother didn't know. What kind of symptoms was she showing, and what did her parents do?
You know, she was got the transfusion when she was 18 months. It was for diarrhea. That's also questionable. Why would the hospital give a blood transfusion for that? But this was the trend then. When she was about 5 or 6 years old, she started to get fevers, colds, diarrhea. from the time of, probably for the next 6 years or so, her mother repeatedly took her back to the hospital, and basically the doctors repeatedly said, oh, it's nothing, just here's some medicine, go home. But they already knew, by the year 2002, they already knew that there was a problem, but they never said anything. Eventually, she got so sick, and the mother lost trust in the hospital, and her mother got a car and drove her 300 kilometers to Xi'an in Shaanxi province, the neighboring province, and took her to a hospital there where doctors immediately knew what the problem was.
And what did they do for her? Is she okay now?
She's doing better than a lot of children. She was treated at this hospital in Xi'an for a few weeks and then was referred to Ditan Hospital in Beijing, which has a section for infectious diseases and for AIDS. And they also work together with the Clinton Foundation to distribute pediatric drugs for AIDS victims.
In the case of Ling Ling, it sounds like her mother was very dogged. And what happens to kids whose moms aren't like Ling Ling's mom?
That's the problem. Like I said, a lot of them aren't getting treated. You know, her mother had only finished primary school, not much education. But, you know, she told me, she said, I couldn't sit there and let my daughter die. And so she was a real fighter, and she doorstepped doctors at the hospital, found the Ditan Hospital, the doctors, they were able to treat her.
And how is the Chinese government dealing with this now?
It's still being covered up, basically. The family tried to sue the hospital, but no courts in Henan or in many provinces will take cases related to AIDS, and this apparently, from what I've been told by lawyers, is what the central government has kind of agreed with this provincial government. So if you cannot bring an AIDS case, they won't accept a case like this.
Why?
Well, because, they're trying to keep it quiet. They're hoping that the problem will just disappear. As one activist told me, local officials, they want to keep it quiet. They're worried about the effect on investment on the economy of the province, and they assume that these people are going to die soon, and once they die, the problem will be gone.
How old is Ling Ling now?
Ling Ling's 14 now. I spent 2 days with her in her home. You know, she doesn't like to leave home. She stays home all day. She's drawing and she's on the internet, but she's very sensitive about this. Wouldn't even allow me to take any pictures. She's kind of depressed by the fact that she doesn't have contact with her friends anymore. She's not going to school. Her mother said she's afraid to go out because she's worried that people see her on the street will ask her questions. And again, she's at home all day, very rarely. His mother said she loves to have visitors. And when we went there, she was very happy when I went down to visit her. And I saw her in Beijing twice. And the second time I saw her, she was very happy. And I've actually chatted with her online. So she misses having contact with people. But, you know, again, her mother's working very hard. And there are some AIDS groups that are working with her also to try to improve her situation.
Paul Mooney in Beijing, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can read Paul Mooney's article from the South China Morning Post on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, last week's unemployment numbers were dramatic, the highest in the last 26 years. Now, that drama is played out on stage. More after a short break. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The trial of the former president of Liberia resumed in The Hague last week. Charles Taylor is the first African leader to be tried before an international tribunal for war crimes. He's accused of murder, rape, and torture during the conflict in Liberia and Sierra Leone in the 1990s. One young man managed to avoid the fighting by turning to knives. Grant Fuller brings us this report as part of our Street Vendor series.
This is the sound of Joseph Parker's life, metal against stone, day in, day out. The 37-year-old straddles a tiny homemade bench with a stone grinding wheel fastened to one end. Parker rhythmically turns the machine with one hand as he angles a customer's knife with the other. All the while, he looks up and jokes with old friends and familiar faces. Parker wears a bright kid in a candy store smile on his face, and that makes him a very popular businessman.
Oh, yeah. I have
a good rapport with my customers. We talk and have fun together, you know? As a businessman, I'm not supposed to be angry all the time. You should be very comfortable and embrace the customers. Then they'll feel free to come around you.
During the Liberian Civil War, which ended 6 years ago, Parker picked up the grinding wheel to avoid having to pick up a gun. By choosing self-employment, he kept himself busy while many other idle young men were joining up with rebel factions. Parker's been sharpening knives for 13 years now, but still insists it's a temporary gig. His ultimate goal is to go to college and get a high-level construction job. While most other knife sharpeners sit in one spot all day long, Parker prefers to walk the streets of Monrovia, visiting regular customers along the way. His first stop is a roadside spot downtown, where a collective of men cut scrap rubber and fashion the pieces into spare auto parts for suspension systems. Parker provides a valuable service here, according to Laif Fofana.
He enables us to do the job faster. Because for the fact that there's no machine, so we have to use knife. Yeah, and the knife have to be sharp. That's the only way the job can be done. Every blessing day that God sent, Parker must come here and do the job for us.
We're taking the shortcut right behind you, yeah?
Parker throws the sharpening bench over his shoulder and walks down a chaotic street to an indoor market. He heads straight for a group of women who cut and sell potato greens, a Liberian staple. He announces his arrival and makes the rounds, collecting about 20 knives to sharpen.
How many knives do you get?
Parker can make $7 a day, which is a very decent wage in Liberia. He's been offered jobs at hardware stores in town, but he makes more money by working on the street.
You tell me to fix machines and you'll give me $40 a month? I can make more than that small amount of money. In a month, I will double it.
Parker returns the sharpened knives to the market women, collects his money, and heads across town to a meat market, his final stop of the day. On the street, as he walks past young men selling cassette tapes out of wheelbarrows, small boys begging, and women hawking cold water in plastic bags, Joseph Parker's still smiling, confident in where knife sharpening will lead him.
If you sit and put your hands between your legs, things will always be hard on you. That's why you see people today struggling to get what they need. There is no food for a lazy man. You gotta keep yourself busy, and if you work towards it, you will get it. That's how it is. And by the grace of God, that's what I'm doing now, working towards my own success.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Monrovia, Liberia.
You can see great photos of Joseph and his knives at our website, worldvisionreport.org. The sound of the grinding wheel may be the soundtrack to Joseph Parker's life. This could be another. It's a favorite in Liberia. It's called Liberian Girl, and it's performed by Liberian-born rapper 2C. This goes out to my Liberian girl. Homegrown, now she's all over the world. People wonder who you are. I'ma show you a shining star. Keep holding your head up. Let nobody put you down. Forever you're my girl. My TT, you're my TT. Liberia rise, Liberia rise. Liberia rise, Liberia rise. Liberia rise, Liberia rise. Liberia rise, Liberia rise. Refugees from the Swat Valley in Pakistan started returning home this week. They fled after the military launched a campaign against the Taliban, which had taken control of the region. Reporter Jared Ferry went to the Swat border to talk to some of those displaced people. As luck would have it, he arrived on a wedding day.
Under a large tent, a group of traditional musicians pounds out relentless rhythms. One of them is a gray-bearded man in a red skullcap. He weaves a hypnotic melody on a wooden wind instrument as young boys dance face to face. Soon they make way for the women. They swirl in circles, laughing and clapping, their hands tattooed with henna with intricate patterns. These people are members of the Christian minority in Swat, and they're here today to celebrate the marriage of Sheila and Wakar. They fled more than a month ago, and they've been staying at this former vocational school run by the Catholic Church. In a classroom where students once trained to be auto mechanics, blankets are piled up against the shell of an old Toyota Land Cruiser. Mats are spread out on the floor where some children play while others nap. These people don't know when they'll be able to go home, and they don't know what will remain of their houses when they do return. But despite everything, today there are smiles and laughter. The groom sits dressed in elaborate clothing for the occasion. He's wearing a blue and gold turban draped with colored beads, and a necklace of large flowers hangs around his neck over a bright red embroidered shawl. Members of his family pose with him for photos. In front of them, the boys continue their frenetic dance. In a former dormitory, the bride is preparing to join the wedding party. She's wearing a simple white dress and bright red lipstick. But she doesn't seem particularly happy. She says she wishes the wedding were taking place as planned at her home in Swat, a beautiful valley that was once a tourist destination. Her friend is more talkative. She's a former teacher, but she hasn't been to work in more than a year since the Taliban forced her girls' school to close down.
Yes, there were threats. They were sending letters also just to close the school and girls should not get the education. They closed the school because of that bad situation. They have to do that. People don't want to kill their children.
She says she hopes she can return to Swat soon, but in the meantime, they're making the best of a bad situation.
We are safe and thank God that we have some place where we can celebrate this. Our home, everything we are missing, it's very difficult. But now, just for our friend, we are doing that. We want to make her happy. I cannot express myself now because I don't want to make her more sad. I think that's enough.
Like millions of others in Pakistan, these people have had their lives torn apart by battles that continue to rage in the mountains of their home district. But life goes on, even in a temporary camp. And on this day, at least, there's room for celebration.
Jared Ferry is a freelance journalist in Asia. In Nigeria, battles over land and resources are commonplace. The one we hear most about is over oil. But far from the oil fields in the north of the country, there's another battle going on that's pitting farmers and nomads against each other. Reporter David Hecht tells us about it.
Adenko is a little village of mud houses in northern Nigeria's Katsina state. People here are from the Hausa ethnic group. They mostly live as subsistence farmers. And one recent morning, people here say they awoke to find 5,000 cattle chomping at their crops. The cattle belong to Fulani nomads, who'd never grazed their cattle here before. Mayagua Gaba is a village elder.
We sent for the police and district head, but in the meantime, we couldn't just stand by and watch the destruction of our crops.
The dispute was settled long before any law enforcement arrived. Gaba said one Fulani fired an automatic weapon at them, but when his ammunition ran out, the tide turned.
We attacked the Fulani with sticks. We beat three of them to death.
The Fulani nomads were no longer around to give their version of events. But other Fulanis living in a village nearby told a different story. Chief Ado Rabo said the Hausa farmers killed the Fulani in order to steal their cattle. The Fulani chief also said that he had never seen a Fulani nomad carrying an automatic weapon. He said the Hausa farmers went on to beat to death one herder whose cattle had been nowhere near Adenko and robbed an innocent Fulani family. The truth of what really happened that day may never be known, but one thing is clear. Every week or so, people kill each other here in fights over land. Fulani women, both young and old, sit in a circle and beat piles of dried ears of corn with sticks to separate the kernels. The women elders say that they remember a time when there wasn't any conflict between farmers and cattle herders. We didn't have this kind of violence when we were growing up, the women say. All Nigerians used to be able to share the land peaceably. Now each group looks to the other as a threat to its survival. That's because Fulani herders have lost much of their traditional grazing land to desertification and are looking for new pastures. And farmers have been expanding their croplands onto areas where the herders traditionally drove their cattle. I got a ride between villages from a local civil servant, Musa Muhammad. He's Fulani and blames northern Nigeria's traditional leaders, or emirs, for exacerbating the conflicts by distributing land to the Hausa farmers without considering the consequences to Fulani grazing.
Nobody thought about that before. And now those lands cannot be seized.
The Hausa farmers say this is their land now. Did they pay money for the land?
They pay.
And back in Adenko, when the farmers were asked about the cattle incursions and the lack of grazing land for their nomad enemies, their tempers boiled.
You think they were looking for trouble? They didn't have to do it.
They said they don't believe it has anything to do with encroaching on the grazing lands. They said the grazing routes and grazing lands here have been preserved.
But for civil servant Musa Muhammad, it's all too easy for both sides to assign blame.
It's not fair to take side, because everybody is losing. The Fulanis are losing their lives, losing their cattle. Likewise, the Hausa farmers are losing their crops, sometimes losing their lives. I feel everybody is cheated.
He says the traditional leaders must start taking responsibility for having distributed the land to farmers in the first place. Land rights groups are calling on the government to open up parts of the north that could be farmed without impeding on Fulani grazing lands. And agricultural associations are pressing farmers to use less land but more productively through irrigation. For the World Vision Report, I'm David Hecht in Adenko, northern Nigeria.
Funding for this report was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. A little later, we hear from a farm worker in Zimbabwe who's lost his job and his home. But first, U.S. unemployment rates continue to rise. That's keeping career advisors and social workers busy. In Hartford, Connecticut, a hometown theater ensemble is reacting to the crisis by taking it to the stage. Amy Jeffries reports.
The government-sponsored career center where Cindy Martinez works just got a new supply of folders, and she's catching up with her filing. Martinez is a career advisor here. She helps 18 to 24-year-olds on welfare find jobs.
So how many folders do you have in the active drawer today?
It's about 120. Today is the day where I get new people. So this afternoon, it might be 125. Who knows?
Martinez estimates her caseload has gone up about 25% in the last year.
And of course, having no jobs is the reason for it. Because the only reason why they would leave this program is if they were fully employed or their cash assistance ran out because they only get 21 months. And if they have an extension, it's only 6 months. But still, eventually the clock is going to run out.
Martinez is also a playwright and actor with the Heartbeat Ensemble, a community theater troupe in Hartford. She's taking the drama of her day job to the stage this summer as part of the ensemble's summer series of plays in public parks.
I would say, you know, plays in the parks is it's Heartbeat's down and dirty way to get out quickly what's going on very contemporarily.
That's Steve Ginsberg, co-artistic director of the ensemble. His co-director Julia Rosenblatt says it was obvious what the summer's plays would focus on.
First and foremost on everyone's mind right now in our area is the economy and how it's affecting our daily lives.
So the ensemble has been rehearsing scripts about how things like the mortgage crisis and corporate bailouts are hitting home in the Hartford area. And Cindy Martinez dug into her case files to write a play set in her cubicle.
I'm showing a go-getter. I'm showing someone who's discriminated against, and that's why they're unemployed, you know. And then another person who is multitasking, she's on the cash assistance, but she's working part-time minimum wage.
The action takes place around a career advisor's desk. Brenda is based on Martinez herself.
So, Julia, why don't you be Brenda Tate? Why don't you be Tia, and I'll be Aaron.
Hi, Tia. Are you here to finally bring me a copy of your LPN license?
Yes, but I'm so frustrated, Ms. Brenda. I have been applying everywhere. I would follow up and everything.
The character Tia, well played in this reading by a man, is actually based on 24-year-old Sarah Gore. Gore's financial crisis started about 2.5 years ago, after she was injured in a car accident. When her short-term disability ran out, she still wasn't able to go back to her warehouse job, so the single mom ended up on welfare.
They only gave me $432 a month, so I had to beg Peter and Paul to pay my rent. And it came to a point where I was just asking, and not ever giving. So I had to cut that out. And then I just thought of the idea, you know, why don't I go to school?
Gore passed her exam to become a licensed practical nurse, but it was another 6 months before she finally found a job.
They cut me off in, I want to say, in February, and I didn't get a job until the end of April. So for that amount of time, I didn't have any cash assistance. They were still giving me food stamps, just food stamps. That was my income.
Playwright Cindy Martinez says Gore's character is that go-getter she referred to earlier.
A lot of people have the stereotype of those who are receiving cash assistance. They're all lazy. And it's really not the case at all. And people, you know, need to realize that it could happen to anyone.
In comes another participant, Aaron, frustrated, not realizing Brenda is already occupied with Tia. Brenda, I only have $93 left of food stamps for the month. How am I supposed to feed me and my son for a month?
I hear you. How much per week you make at your job?
$75.
Cindy Martinez hopes that her play will offer audiences in Hartford's public parks this summer the kind of perspective Sarah Gore gained from going through Connecticut's welfare program.
If I didn't go through none of that, I wouldn't be a nurse right now. That forced me to take a look at reality.
Martinez believes seeing stories like Gore's on stage can empower people to improve their lives or avoid crisis in the first place.
Theater just really draws you in, and before you know it, you're like, wow, okay. That's what happened to that person. How does that relate to me? And is there something I should look out for, something I should be preventing or fixing or improving on?
For the World Vision Report, I'm Amy Jeffries in Hartford, Connecticut.
Just ahead, we speak to Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dime, about how the poorest of the poor are faring in this recession. Stay with us.
In our days, we will live like our ghosts will live. Pigeon glass.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Author Barbara Ehrenreich is once again bringing our attention to the plight of the poor in the U.S. A few years ago, she learned firsthand what it means to live on minimum wage in the U.S. She worked as a maid, a waitress, and a nursing home assistant. And then she wrote about her experience in her best-selling book called Nickel and Dimed. Now Barbara Ehrenreich is writing a series of essays for the New York Times about how the recession is hurting those who were already struggling to make ends meet. Welcome, Barbara, to the show.
Well, thank you.
Barbara, we've heard a lot about the struggles that many in the middle class in this country are having with foreclosures and job losses. But it's true that we haven't heard an awful lot about those who were already struggling, the ones that you profiled in your book, waitresses, people at minimum wage jobs.
Yeah, and that's what prompted me to go to the New York Times and pitch the idea of some reported essays on the effect of the recession on the already poor. And I said, you know, when I went to the talked to the editor there, maybe it's not a story. Maybe the real, you know, man bites dog story is about the wealthy person who has to give up their personal jet or something. And as I did the reporting, as I plunged into research, I saw it wasn't that way at all. That, you know, for one thing, the unemployment is running three times as high among blue-collar people as it is with white-collar people. The working class, many of whom are poor, they're the people taking the brunt of this recession.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the folks you visited? What did you find, besides the fact that the unemployment rate was much higher, which must have been quite a surprise?
Partly, you know, the people whose stories I've drawn on for this, one was a person in my own extended family and a woman in rural Missouri. I got the call about her through the family because she was facing foreclosure a few months ago. And the backstory I thought was really appalling as a 55-year-old woman who had been holding down three part-time jobs in order to support herself, her daughter, and two grandchildren, all of whom live with her. The daughter's disabled, unable to work. So this woman, 55-year-old woman, had the three jobs, had a heart attack, fell behind on her mortgage payments, and was facing eviction. Now, what makes it even worse is, you know, when I learned that this isn't a house we're talking about, it's a single wide trailer that they are all crammed into. But, you know, the way the recession figures in this is it's so hard for her now to find any of these part-time jobs to sustain her and her family with.
And so are these people ending up reaching out to family and friends, or how are they getting by if something like this happens and they can't find a job?
Yeah, I mean, obviously reaching out to family, and in this case, I was in line as a member of the family to be reached out to. But so I think that's what most people do. You know, as I've talked to people over and over, I see among coping mechanisms, one is reaching out, you know, and maybe the brother-in-law has $50 to spare. Maybe somebody can help that way, or knows somebody knows who where a job might be. But the other way of coping is very often just crowding into more, you know, more and more packed dwellings. But that just seems to be the rule everywhere. And it's so hidden. Nobody likes to confess to having the degree of overcrowding that's going on right now in so many homes.
If unemployment is three times the rate of white-collar unemployment, it's no wonder the working poor are in dire straits right now.
Well, they were in dire straits before because the jobs available to them often didn't really pay enough to live on.
Right, but now they've got no jobs at all.
Yeah, I mean, people have been working through years of what we call prosperity on wages that you can't make ends meet with.
Barbara, in your most recent op-ed piece for the New York Times, you profile the family of Kristen and Joe Parente. And their troubles started before the recession hit. Can you tell us a little bit about them and what happened to them?
Yeah, this is a married couple in Wilmington, Delaware. They have three small children. I think the oldest is eight. Joe Parente had intended to be the sole breadwinner of the family. But 8 years ago, when he was only 22, he injured his back in some way that rendered him, well, unfit for being a pipe fitter anymore, and that's what he was, a pipe fitter. You know, he can't really do any kind of heavy manual labor. He took a course to learn computer repair. He did very well in that course, but now there's no demand for computer repair people. His wife, Kristen, had not intended to be in the workforce. She intended to be a stay-at-home mom. She's been a waitress. She lost her last job in January. There are no more waitressing jobs that she could find. And they're really stuck. I mean, I just have to tell you one awful catch-22 here. You would think that Joe might qualify for disability benefits. He can't qualify for them unless he presents a brand new up-to-date MRI of his back. And he can't afford to get that done because that would cost about $800. And he's not eligible for Medicaid. So he's stuck.
Now, I thought that in your article you said Kristen finally got a job as a community organizer. How is this working for her?
Well, this is kind of interesting. You know, she went for help finally to TANF, T-A-N-F, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, which is what replaced what used to be aid to families with dependent children. It's not a program where you can just walk in and say, hey, we're hungry, we need help. It's a program that was designed just to supplement the wages of low-wage people. So you go to the TANF office, they're not going to give you money unless you, quote, work in some way. Now, at first for Kristen, that meant she had to apply for 40 jobs a week. Although at the time she was living in a rural area and did not have a reliable car to get to those jobs.
This is the rule that if you apply for welfare, you have to apply for 40, you have to be out interviewing for 40 jobs a week? And if so, how's that even possible?
it's not. I mean, in her case, there weren't even 40 places to apply to around where she lived. Rules vary from state to state. Then they found her a job as a volunteer, which was considered all right, because, then she's not, wallowing in welfare dependency or whatever it is they're afraid will happen to people. So she got a job volunteering for ACORN, the National Community Organizing Group. And she made such a good impression there that they eventually did hire her full time. And she gets some supplementation still from temporary assistance to needy families, but very little.
So Joe is not working. Kristen has a job not making very much, and they've got three young kids. How are they making ends meet? Is this enough?
No, it's definitely not. I've been to visit them. The place they were living in when I visited was not even legally zoned for residential use. It was meant to be for commercial use. So, for example, there was no stove in the kitchen. And what really worried the Parentes was they had it in their minds, and I could not verify this one way or another, that they had to have their siblings of opposite sex separated. You know, you couldn't have the little boy who's 5 in the same bedroom with the little girl who's 7 or something. So what makes that's a problem, because this is a one bedroom situation.
So I'm wondering, for people who are in this situation, who are working a minimum wage, barely paying their rent, and then they lose their jobs, how difficult is it to get government assistance, whether it's food stamps or some kind of aid? How long does it take to get through that system? Did you follow anyone else through it?
It's variable. I've talked to many people in different states about their experiences. Food stamps is probably the easiest of them. Although I should say, a number of states, some of our largest states, do still treat food stamp applicants as if they were criminals. You get fingerprinted. That's not a good experience. Unemployment insurance, unfortunately, does not apply to most people who've held low-wage jobs, because there are these bizarre, fiendishly complex rules for who is eligible for unemployment insurance. They vary from state to state and from unemployment office to unemployment office within a state. And nationwide, something like 60, I've even read as high as 70% of people who get laid off are not eligible for unemployment insurance. So there's not much of a safety net here.
No, let's talk about that. We hear about the government attempts, a safety net, so to speak, to help people who are in the middle of foreclosures. But how much is that kind of help on the part of the government going to help the group that you're talking about, the working poor?
Well, somewhat. With the working poor, the big foreclosure issue has to do with being a renter and then finding suddenly that you're being evicted because your landlord has been foreclosed on and he or she hasn't bothered to tell you that this problem was looming. There's even a very courageous sheriff, I think, in the Chicago area, who simply refused to evict people under those circumstances. You know, it had nothing to do with them. They'd paid their rent. The landlord had taken their rent checks.
Is there any light at the end of this tunnel? Are there any efforts underway on the part of the Obama administration or any civic groups to help the working poor in America get through this crisis?
Well, the Obama administration has made some temporary expansions of both unemployment insurance and food stamps. That's not a bad thing. But I think we have not addressed in this country the fact that we really don't have a working safety net. You know, there's no form of cash assistance where you can just go down to an office and say, help, I've got, nothing, I need help right away. I mean, in the case of the Parentes, they waited weeks and weeks, almost 3 months, I think, before they saw any money at all, during which they were just, it was just hand to mouth and not enough food for the children or for the grown-ups. So we don't have a functioning safety net, and I think we have to address that. We also need to generate jobs. If the private sector is not able to generate jobs at the rate that we need, then I would say we should go back to a New Deal approach and have the government step in and generate jobs in vital areas, whether that's fixing the physical infrastructure or taking care of small children or whatever.
Isn't that what the stimulus package is about?
There's a question. What happened to that?
Yeah.
We don't really know.
I'm curious. Do you have another article coming up?
Yes.
What's your next assignment?
The next thing I'm doing, and I'm pretty free to do what I want, has to do with what a lot of people are calling the criminalization of poverty. One thing that means is the targeting of urban communities, often communities of color, by the police for all sorts of violations: jaywalking, littering, loitering, broken headlight, everything, which can get you a fine. Then when you don't pay the fine because you don't have the money, there's a warrant out for you. And at that point, of course, you enter the criminal justice system and you can pretty much give up on getting a job. And the other way that poverty has been criminalized is that it's sort of illegal to be homeless in America. Nothing to help you, but you can't sleep on the street. You can't even sit on the street in most places. If you try to build your tent city, it will be probably closed in a police sweep, in which you might lose all of your tiny number of belongings.
Now, this idea of targeting the poor, whether it's jaywalking or broken headlight, as you mentioned, this isn't something new, or is it something that you see growing?
No, it's not something new. It goes back, really took off in the 90s with Giuliani's crackdown in New York, the whole broken windows theory of policing, that if you were really tough on the minor infractions, you would stop big crime too. That's where it started. But to my personal horror, this stuff has actually increased since 2007.
And why the increase in this targeting? Is this tied at all to the current economic downturn?
You know, I'd love to know that. I have talked to community organizers who perhaps, this may be paranoid, who think that cities are doing more of this kind of policing because they want the revenue from the fines now because of the recession. I have no way of establishing whether that's true or not. But that's just to give you the impression on the ground.
Barbara Ehrenreich, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author most recently of This Land is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation. You can read her essays from the New York Times at our website, worldvisionreport.org. In Zimbabwe, white farmers have been thrown off their land as part of the government's controversial redistribution plan. As a result, more than 1 million black farm workers and their families have lost their jobs and their homes. Before the redistribution program started in the year 2000, agriculture was Zimbabwe's biggest employer. It provided food not just for the country, but other parts of Africa. Now, 7 million out of 9 million people rely on food aid. Many hoped that the new unity government would put an end to the seizure of white-owned farmland. But so far, that hasn't happened. Here's the story from one farm worker named Crispin in his own words.
My name is Crispin. I am 38 years old, and I was working on the farm for 10 years. I was the foreman. On the 19th of January, people who said they are veterans of Zimbabwe's War of Liberation came, and they said they were taking over the farm. After the invaders ran my boss off the farm, I stayed, but then they started accusing me of reporting what they were doing on the farm. They were busy looting stuff, and they said myself and the driver were telling on them because we were too close to the boss. I was beaten up twice, and then told to go and never set foot on the farm again. I have heard that the workers who stayed behind have since left because they were not getting paid enough or not getting paid at all. I also hear that there is no farming activity going on at the farm. Life has been very difficult since. Besides my wife, I looked after five children, some of whom were in school. They had to drop out, as I cannot afford to pay school fees for them anymore. My boss took me into the servants' quarters at a house he now lives in Harare. I share those quarters with a gardener. There are eight of us sharing a single room. I'm not getting paid, but I get very basic rations. I know my boss is trying to get the farm back through the courts, and I hope that if he wins, we can go back to the farm. I have been looking for work, but nothing has come up. I was hoping that having the new government would make life a lot easier for us, but it does not seem to be the case. I just pray that things will change soon.
Crispin's story was produced by Ish Mafundukwa. And that's it for this week. Remember to visit our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can sign up for a podcast there. And there are details on how to become a fan of the World Vision Report on Facebook. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber, Christina Darden, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.